This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega.
No hate, no fear. Refugees are welcome here. No hate, no fear.
It's been 2 years since President Trump issued an executive order blocking entry to people from several Muslim-majority countries. The announcement brought protests at airports across the country and a slew of lawsuits. Back in June, the Supreme Court upheld a slightly modified version of that ban, and in his majority opinion, Chief Justice John Roberts cited the robust waiver process that was built into the ban. Theoretically, that would allow would-be immigrants to qualify for entry if they met certain criteria. But in the months since, many people who've applied for waivers say they're unsure what those criteria are, and they're still unable to bring their loved ones to the United States. In July 2018, a class action lawsuit was filed against the Trump administration, calling the waiver process inconsistent and arbitrary.
My name is Ismail Ahmed Al-Jazawi. I'm 25 years old. I'm from Yemen, and I'm a U.S. citizen.
Ismail is one of those plaintiffs. He's married to a Yemeni woman named Hind, and he's tried sponsoring her for a visa to immigrate to the United States. The couple fled the Yemeni civil war at the end of 2017. Last January, they managed a difficult journey to the nearest U.S. embassy in Djibouti for Hind's visa interview.
We went to the U.S. embassy, and it didn't take only like 5 minutes for the interview. They asked us a simple question, do you guys meet each other? It was just quick questions, like 5 minutes, and they gave my wife the refusal paper. What she's mean is refused. Her case is refused under Section 212F, because it's Muslim ban.
The United States denied Hind a visa at a critical moment for their family.
A month after the interview, that's when my wife gave birth. We were struggling, facing a hard time. No income. I was borrowing money from family, friends to cover our expense. And it was very hot. And Djibouti is a place where you don't want to be at because life is hard over there. Everything's expensive, rent, electrical.
Even before their son was born, Ismail and Hind had planned to build a life together in the U.S.
I wanted to bring my wife with me to the United States because she wanted to continue school and stuff. She wanted to be an RN. We have dreams and we can't live separate from each other. Plus, Yemen is a war and there is a lot going on there.
Like many other in Ismail's position, he and his family have hung their hopes on moving to the United States, but this time on a waiver.
I actually contacted the U.S. Embassy. I sent them a letter, explained everything that I was going through, and I sent them, asking them, please, give me the waiver program. Do something. Do your best for me. They sent me a letter. They said, we understand what you're going through, but that is a necessary process that your case is going through right now, and we don't know how long this process will take.
As months went by, the situation for the family was becoming desperate. The only solution they saw was for Ismail to return to the U.S. to work, meaning that Hind and their baby would be forced to return to Yemen.
I didn't even want to send them back home, but I have no choice. I have to put them on a plane going back home to Yemen, the worst place. I end up coming back to the United States for my job. After they got in Yemen, 2 weeks later, I was calling them, trying to contact them, make sure they're all right. And the first thing I heard my wife saying, there is no baby food, any supermarket or any store you go.
For now, they wait for an answer to their waiver request.
They said it'll take several weeks, and it's been months and months. I haven't received nothing. Since August, I haven't heard anything at all.
Faiza Patel has been following the implementation of the ban since its inception. She's the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center. Faiza, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Great to be here.
So can you give us a sense of how common stories like Ismail's are?
So we've certainly seen a number of people applying for waivers, which is the only way for people from the Muslim ban countries to actually get into the United States and reunite with family. And most of the time, there's no process in place in the consulates for actually applying for a waiver. and the rate at which waivers are granted is really, really small. The best number we have dates back to April of 2018, at which point 572 waivers had been granted out of a total of roughly 27,000 people who were eligible for waivers. So that's, you know, a rate of about 2%. So I think it's safe to assume that the overwhelming portion of the people who apply for waivers are being denied.
What are the criteria? Because we started this story talking about the fact that there seemed to be some confusion about what exactly the United States is looking for to allow people into the country. So is there any clarity around what that is?
So that's a huge problem for people. So according to the Muslim Ban Executive Order, the waiver process was sort of a safety valve, right? So that people who had real humanitarian needs would be allowed to come into the country. In fact, there has been no guidance issued by the government as to what actually constitutes the kind of circumstances that would allow an individual to be granted a waiver and allowed to come here. And what we've seen instead is some leaked documents, some Freedom of Information Law requests have come up with documents. And one of the things we do know is that conditions in your home country are not enough. Wanting to reunite with your family is not enough. What the government seems to be looking for is some kind of dire emergency. You know, we saw the case last week or so about this young mother who was kept away from her toddler who was dying in the United States. And even then, they didn't grant a waiver until there was a huge amount of press attention and public pressure. But those are the kind of life and death situations, it seems, that the government has been receptive to.
The couple that we talked about, Hind and Ismail, were fleeing the war in Yemen. Is that not considered dire enough?
Absolutely not. And you can see that even in our refugee numbers. You know, our refugee numbers are in the low hundreds from Syria at this point. Overall, Muslim refugees are down 90%. That's definitely not enough for this administration to let anybody into the country.
So we're going to play some tape for you from a couple, a married couple who we reached out to who are in Saudi Arabia. The couple is Sahar and Joshua. Sahar is originally from Yemen. Under this executive order, she's barred entry to the United States, even though her husband is a U.S. citizen. Joshua, her husband, says that an immigration official told him to apply for a waiver for his wife. And here's how Joshua explained the situation.
He said, well, the waiver is something that, you know, there's no formula where this document plus this document equals approval. It's just a case-by-case basis. But basically, you need to prove that if she doesn't get the visa, it would be undue hardship on her, undue hardship on you, and that she's not a national security risk. And I got together a lot of documents that showed that she actually has never lived in Yemen. And I tried to submit those, but they wouldn't accept those. So they took a very limited number of documents. And they said 4 to 8 weeks. I submitted that in September. I'm still waiting. So it's been almost 16 weeks now.
This is exactly the kinds of stories that we've heard. You know, no process, no clear rules about, you know, what actually counts. You know, no documentation that they consider necessary for these kinds of things. But I think the story also points up, you know, one of the most fundamental sort of logical flaws with the ban, right? So this gentleman's wife had never lived in Yemen, right? But she's being excluded because of her Yemeni passport on the theory that the Yemeni government is not providing the U.S. information about her. Now, the Yemeni government has no information about her other than the fact that she's a passport holder because this woman has lived somewhere else all her life. And this is very typical of the sort of logical fallacy that's at the heart of the ban.
Our first story that we heard, Ismail, he's part of a class action lawsuit. I'm wondering, there are many legal challenges that have been raised. Do you expect any of those lawsuits to change the process, to move this process forward after, particularly in light of the Supreme Court's decision?
So I think there's two sets of cases that we really have to watch. So one is that most people assume that the overall challenge to the ban has finished after the Supreme Court decision, and that's actually not the case. The Supreme Court decision was on a preliminary injunction motion, right? It was lawyers running into court saying, stop this. This is illegal. This is unconstitutional. This is harming people. And the Supreme Court declined to let that injunction stay in place. That doesn't mean that the underlying case necessarily goes away. And the court actually remanded that case back down to the district court. So people who the Brennan Center is representing, as well as other plaintiffs, are now back in district court in Maryland challenging the ban and seeking to get information from the government that will allow us to demonstrate, as if more proof were needed, that this ban is actually based on religious animus and not national security concerns. So that's one set of lawsuits that's ongoing. The other set, as you referred to, is the class action that's been brought against the waiver scheme. Now, the waiver scheme is quite interesting because the government made a big deal of the waiver scheme when they were arguing for the legality of the ban and said, look, we're being humanitarian. This is showing you that, you know, we don't just want to keep people out because they're Muslim. And certainly the dissenting justices kind of pointed to the waiver scheme as a way to potentially push back against the ban. One of the things that has been alleged in this case, and I think that's a really powerful argument based on all the stories we're hearing, is that really this implementation of this waiver scheme is just arbitrary. And, you know, under our legal system, that's not permitted. And that, I think, is a very strong basis for that case to go ahead as well.
Well, and the administration also cited in their execution of this ban, if you will, national security, as you mentioned. Have we seen any proof that this has actually helped the United States in a national security capacity?
Well, it was never about national security. And we had national security officials from across the political spectrum going back several administrations saying, this is not how you do national security, that nationality is not a proxy for somebody's riskiness in terms of terrorism. So I don't think we've seen any particular national security benefit. I don't know exactly how you would measure that, to tell you the truth, but it was always a fig leaf. And frankly, you know, this administration has taken the tendency to use national security as a cover for doing whatever it is you want to another extreme. But we should all remember that using national security as a fig leaf is an old and tried tradition.
Well, I think we also see that playing out here on our southern border. There's a lot of rhetoric around that. But I guess the question is really to show whether or not the administration's stated purpose for putting this out there has actually had yielded any results. And I'm not sure if that's actually happened. Is the travel ban in effect indefinitely?
Yes, it is in effect indefinitely. There is a process by which countries can go off the travel ban list. And we've seen Chad, for example, was removed from that list, although it was never very clear why it was on the list to begin with. So the travel ban is in effect indefinitely. And we've certainly seen the impacts of it, obviously the individual stories that we're hearing, but also in terms of the numbers. So, you know, even outside of the countries affected by the travel ban, from Muslim countries overall, we've seen a drop of about 30% in immigrant visas, a drop of about close to 20% in tourist visas. So certainly the country is closing to Muslims, whether it's through the Muslim ban or whether it's through, you know, other bureaucratic means for making it more difficult for people to get visas. All of these things are happening on the ground.
Faiza Patel is with the Brennan Center for Justice. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.